Good morning. My name's Nicole Aberdeen, not Richard Buckham. As you probably realised, he's unable to be here, so I've got the honour of doing this session today. Welcome. I'd like to begin by acknowledging that this land that we meet on today is the traditional land for the Kaurna people and that I respect their spiritual relationship with their country. I also acknowledge the Kaurna people as the custodians of the Adelaide region and that their cultural and heritage beliefs are still as important to the living Kaurna people today. This morning, it's my very great pleasure to be in conversation with British writer and journalist Polly Toynbee and Australian writer and journalist Martin Flanagan about their recent memoirs. Polly's is called An Uneasy Inheritance, My Family and Other Radicals, and Martin's The Empty Honour Board, a school memoir. Before I introduce Polly and Martin, could you please switch all your mobile phones to silent? Polly. Polly Toynbee is a journalist and author. Formerly the BBC's social affairs editor, she's currently a Guardian columnist and broadcaster. She's written for The Observer, The Independent and Radio Times and has been an editor at Washington Monthly. She's won numerous awards, including a National Press Award and the Orwell Prize for Journalism. She describes her book, An Uneasy Inheritance, with disarming frankness, as a book about self-conscious awareness of privilege, embarrassment at undeserved good fortune, and uncertainty about how to live with uneasy consciences. Martin Flanagan. Martin is a journalist and writer who writes about sport, Australian culture, and the relationship between Indigenous and non-Indigenous Australians. He has also written many books, fiction and non-fiction, including a poetry collection, collections of his newspaper writing, and an autobiographical novel, Going Away. He's written a play and two film treatments. From 1985 to 2017, he wrote for the Melbourne Age on sport and other subjects, including a popular weekly football column, One of the Crowd. Martin was born in 1955. He graduated in law from the University of Tasmania in 1975. Please make Polly and Martin welcome.
Thank you.
So I'm going to start with the obvious question because I think it's nice for listeners to hear this from you in your own words. Polly, what is An Uneasy Inheritance about and why that title?
It's a book, it's a memoir. It's about my family going back several generations and about middle classness. Lots of people write very good, excellent memoirs about making it from nowhere, getting themselves up the ladder. This is a book about being born up the ladder for generation after generation with a silver spoon, if you like, and a sense of privilege, but particularly acute in my family because we were all left-wingers all the way back, liberals, Labour, campaigners for every kind of good cause, back to my Australian origins of my great-great-grandfather was born in Australia, and they were all campaigners, you know, against capital punishment, in favour of women's suffrage, every passionately anti-imperial. And all of them lived a life of comfort because they were all professionals. Most of them were professors, living comfortable lives with uncomfortable consciences. How do you square having left-wing views and living a life of privilege? So I tried to explore that, my own feelings about that, and theirs too, and the often comical ways in which they tried to get around it.
There's so many passages that I've underlined in this book, but fabulous descriptions of what you're talking about. This is one of my favourites. A history of a liberal heritage, of lives lived on the left, mostly struggling to be good, but inevitably never being good enough. Could you talk a little bit about that, about the struggle to be good, but the feeling that you're never good enough?
Well, you're always well aware. If you're born with a sense of privilege, and you nobody is more acutely aware of it than people who are on the left side of politics, you are never going to be good enough unless you give everything away and live a life like Mahatma Gandhi. So unless you're willing to give everything away. And, you know, a lot of my family did give quite a lot away. you know that you were always like that story in the Bible where, you know, the rich man is not going to go to heaven any more than a camel is going to get through the eye of a needle. And you're very aware of this, that nothing is ever good enough. Because even if you give everything away, you've still been born with the privilege of education. Because it was mostly the privilege of education in my family that was passed on from generation to generation. And that's something you can't take away from people.
And Polly, I can't resist, you've mentioned and you write about an Australian forebear, Gilbert Murray. Tell us a bit about him.
Gilbert Murray was born, he was the son of a very successful, of Irish origin, man Sir Terence Murray, who was an administrator, was a magistrate, and became the Speaker of the New South Wales Parliament. And but like lots of other people, he made a lot of money briefly, lost it all, ended up an alcoholic with nothing at all, and died rather young. So his Gilbert, my great grandfather's mother, brought him to England, where they arrived with no money at all and had to get scholarships everywhere. And he got scholarships all the way through until he became the Regius Professor of Greek at Oxford University. Mm. But very much with a strong strong sense of Australian origins. But again, they were out on a limb because his father was a great sponsor collector of First National languages and a passionate supporter of them, passionately in favour of their rights at a time when it was really an eccentric thing to be if you were an official. And always brought up with this sense of injustice and of defending the people around you who were, you know, being done down, always on the side of the underdog. Mm. So that's the Australian-Irish side.
Mm. Martin, your book, it's called The Empty Honour Board. Could you tell us what it's about and what's the meaning of that title?
The book is about... I went to a Catholic boarding school when I was 10. I was there for 6 years, and it was a school where sexual abuse and bullying were endemic, and I encountered both of them. And the place had a great effect on me. And the book is basically about what happened there and about how I came to terms with it. For better and for worse, because I think my experiences there gave me my strength as a journalist, because as a journalist I couldn't bear anyone to interfere with my work. In journalism, as I've experienced it, there's always someone who wants to interfere with your work. So that's what I think the book's about. It got its title from the fact that in my year on the school honour board, there are actually no names. And in my final year, there was a scandal where a priest basically raped a kid, and I was the deputy school captain, and the kid came to me. And 30 years later, I gave evidence in court on behalf of that kid. But that was one reason, I think, why there's no names on our honour board. But the effect of the place on me was that it wasn't the sexual abuse that got to me as much as the bullying. And when I was, 10, 11, 12, I don't know why, but When bullying happened around me, when I saw other kids get bullied, particularly, it was always the misfit kid or the fat kid or the backward kid, and I felt it was my responsibility to defend that child, and I could never do it. And from that I got a sense of failure and of shame. And so there was no honour in that school for me, or really for anyone else, because there was no innocence in the place. So that's why the title of the book is The Empty Honour Book.
So I want to ask both of you a little bit about what prompted you to write this memoir. Polly, I've got some idea. You were making a radio series in 2011 called The Class Ceiling, and your producer asked you to say something about your own experience of social class, and you clammed up. You say that you've written this book to answer your own question, how do I feel about social class? And I'm wondering, has writing it helped you to unravel the answer? And if it has, what is the answer?
Yep. I've never written about myself before. All of my reporting, my journalism, my books have all been about, you know, the world outside, never about myself. So it was with taking a deep breath. But I think the producer asking me that question, saying, look, you're asking everybody, I was going around with a tape recorder asking people, what do you feel about social class? How has it affected your life? And I find it's the most revealing question you can ask anybody. Everybody always comes up with a really good story. Tell me sometime when you either felt too posh or not posh enough. Mm. And everybody has a story of embarrassments in one way or another, or of grievance in one way or another. So asking it of myself was really awkward, because I thought, well, I don't really have a class story. I wish I had a lovely story to tell about, you know, working class origins somewhere, about something somewhere. My family has always been the same as long as I can find. I looked very hard to find a root, a branch, a twig of anything working class. Nothing. Not one. But and the reason people do that is because it, if you are middle class, it gives you credibility. Oh, well, I made it on my own merit. I have no idea what my own merit is because I came from nowhere, exactly the world that I was born in. And I think exploring it has made me less embarrassed. It's made me face up to the embarrassments of all of that, of people looking at you going, well, you were born with a silver spoon, weren't you? And by facing up to it really honestly and discussing it and thinking about it honestly, I'd say it is absurd to go about feeling guilty. You should do what you can, wherever you are, and it's no good just clamming up and hoping nobody notices what your voice sounds like. You know, the great betrayal is your voice.
I wondered if, in part, this book was a bit of a preemptive strike. You've indicated, not surprisingly, that you're worried that your right-wing opponents in the press and generally will use this as fuel for the fire to continue their allegations against you of being a champagne socialist. But it seemed to me this was rather a clever thing to do, to preempt that and to own it, as it were, and to thus sort of take the wind out of their sails and take the sting out of that accusation. Is that part of what you were trying to do as well?
No, I didn't expect that at all. I thought I was going to be slaughtered. As in Australia, the newspaper world is deeply divided politically, the Murdoch press and the rest. And so I thought, here is their opportunity to really have a go. Right, Polly Toynbee writes about middle class. That's a joke. But amazingly, I think by being brutally honest, and I got my kids to look at it too, saying, you haven't been honest about this and you haven't been honest about that, to keep being completely honest, where there's nothing they can find that you've actually been hypocritical about. Mm. And so in the end, I ended up, to my amazement, getting good reviews in the Times and the Sunday Times and even in the Mail on Sunday, which is, oh, astonishing. Mm. So in the end, I haven't had the scorching I was expecting.
Mm. Martin, your memoir, as you say, is about a time that you spent in a Catholic school at a very very formative years. You were aged 11 to 16. It was from 1966 to 1971. And you've told us what happened, but just to be absolutely clear, 3 of the 12 priests then at the school have since gone to prison for sexual abuse committed while you were there. Mm. What made you decide to write about that now, over 50 years later?
In 2016, 2017... there were a series of stories written about my school on ABC Online in Tasmania, and then the Pearl scandal happened on top of it. And so there was a lot of discussion, but it was totally binary in nature. It was all black and white. And I had come out that this was my life. I came out of this place and it just, no one was speaking for me. And one day I said to my older brother, who'd also gone to the school, Don't you think it's strange that all these people who weren't at our school are certain they know what happened, and you and I were at the school and we're not certain? And he said, yeah, that's strange. And so I kept on waiting for someone else to write something of a documentary nature, something that went to the actual experience, and no one did. So in the end, I thought, oh, well, I will. But I didn't want to do it because I knew I'd have to expose myself more than I'd ever exposed myself in anything I'd written. But I started it, and then my older brother, who's a doctor, he's had cancer twice, and he's thought a lot about what he wants to do with such time as he's got left. And none of the kids had been to this school had had anything to do with one another. There was no old boys association. And he brought a group of 12 of them back one day, and I went along, and I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, hang on, I like you. Why have I cut you out of my life? And then one of them persuaded me to go to a day the school held, what was called a ritual of lament for the victims of sexual abuse. And I hadn't expected, I don't like ritual. I find meaning gets lost in ritual for me, and I don't like religious language. It doesn't move me. So I was very reluctant to go. And then these three fellas got up. And the first one was a boy who left in my last year to become a priest. And this was from one of the most conservative towns in Australia at the time. And he gets up and he's talking to the local Catholic parish. And I was there when he left, and it was such a big deal. And in a sense, those people were part of it because they had sort of silently cheered him on, and they had cultivated the idea that the priests were these semi-divine beings. And this fella stood up and told them that he'd been trapped into a sexual abuse into a sexual relationship with a priest before he went, and that he'd gone to see this priest to ask about being a priest, and that's where it had started. And it was that. It's one thing to say those things at a literary festival like this, it's another to go back to the people where that story comes from and say it to them. And then the next fellow got up, and he was an officer in the Air Force, very, you know, upright military sort of fella, and he'd been trapped into a sexual relationship with a priest when he was 14. And his wife is standing with him, and he told the local parish that, and he said, I got to adulthood and I was attracted to women, but if the truth be told, I was more attracted to men. And I had never heard truth-telling of that order. And so I started it for the reason I said, but then one of those fellows who made the speech, the fellow who was going to be a priest, he was actually dying, and I decided I wanted to write the book for him so that he could know that his story had got out before he died. So that was why I finished it.
Martin, you showed the manuscript. You showed the manuscript to a trusted friend before you published it, and he read it, but he gave you a warning about it. What was the warning?
Nearly everyone told me not to do it. My own family told me not to do it, or some members of my own family told me not to do it. My best friend read it, and he rang me and said, don't publish it. You're too hard on yourself. But it wasn't my intention to judge myself as an 11 and 12-year-old. It was more that I was trying to describe. It's like we're all like clay that's moulded into a pot, and I was trying to show that the manner in which I'd been moulded. And then I have a Jewish friend who I've done a lot of Aboriginal stories with, and he's a doctor, and he said to me, if you're going to publish this, it should come with a warning, because it will, I think he said something like, it will inspire some but it could send others into a downward spiral that they can't get out of, because what got me out of it was writing, but that was my ladder out. But not everyone's got that ladder. Not everyone has a ladder. So the book does come with a warning.
So did that weigh heavily on you, Martin, that warning, him having said that, you know, the book should come with a trigger warning, as it were. Did it weigh heavily on you, that responsibility of the impact that your book might have on those who read it?
I had nothing but fear. I mean, it was going back to the worst period of my life. It was having to listen to all those voices again. In the act of writing, you have to relive all that. But by having it published as a book, you invite those voices back into your life. I mean, my biggest fear was that one of those kids from that school, because that school had put a fundamental doubt into me, that one of them would re-emerge and say, "This is bullshit, you're a bullshitter, you always were. We know who you are because we know who you were back then." And that's why I wrote in the book, when one of my books came out and it got a really bad review, I told this Aboriginal fella, and he lives up on the Murray River, and he said, "Come up here, brother, we'll smoke you, we'll protect you from that shit." And he did. And that was when I began to learn that any compliment or criticism, the weight of any compliment or criticism is in direct proportion to the respect you've got for the person making it. And that's what I didn't know when I was 10, 11 and 12. And that's why when I heard all these voices at 10, 11 and 12, I believed them. And then I suppressed them, and it all came out when my wife was pregnant with our first child, when I went mad.
So that brings me neatly to the next thing I wanted to talk about. When I was thinking about this session, and I was thinking about what is it that really makes a memoir great, and a couple of things, there were sort of two or three things that I thought of. One of them was candour, one of them was authenticity, one of them was humour, and one of them, the title of this session, I think, is The God Is in the Details. And both of you, your stories are you've got, both of your memoirs have all those things. We're going to come to the detail and some of the anecdotes later, but I'd like to stop at the moment on candour. You are both unafraid to reveal things about yourselves that you're not proud about. And Martin, let's segue into that. For you, the biggest thing that you're not proud of, that you're ashamed about, that you explore in your book, is that you didn't do enough to stand up for kids who were bullied at your school, sometimes quite horrifically. And you said that my inaction in the face of violence seemed a colossal moral failure. And you describe in your book what you've just started to talk about, that in your 20s, when your wife was pregnant with your first child, you had a crisis of sorts. Could you tell us about that, about what happened?
Well, when I left the school, I just didn't want to know about it. I didn't want to think about it. I didn't want to have anything to do with it. I went to university, and they were the golden years, and, you know, in the 70s, and university was enormous fun, and suddenly life was wonderful. And then I met my wife, and she got pregnant, and I started to get deeply irrational fears, night panics, which I'd never had, it was terrifying, and I didn't know what was going on. And I mentioned it to my brother Richard, and he said to me, he'd read in a Buddhist text once, that if you get overwhelmed by vague fear, ask its name, invite it in. Who are you? So I did that, asked its name, and it said boarding school, and I thought, oh, Christ, not please, no. I don't want to go back there again. I love my father and I respect him, but he'd been on the Burma Railway, and he was between Nagasaki and Hiroshima when the bombs went off, and he hardly spoke. I'd never, ever had a conversation about anything like this with him. But I wrote and told him sort of what was going on, the fears I was having. And he wrote back and he said that when they came home from the prison camps, they were told they could have irrational feelings of that sort. And that was a wonderful moment, because I didn't think there was anyone on the planet going through what I was going through. And I thought, oh, so maybe I'm not the only one. And then he said he'd once heard an Anglican clergyman say, life is like feeling your way through a dark room. And that was the vital clue for me, because at that point I stopped intellectualising it and I just went with my senses. And I started each day keeping a diary, and I recorded any image or any story which gave me comfort and which gave me solace and which gave me hope. And I was sort of reborn in a whole different philosophy of life and also of writing, and that's really where my writing comes out of. And one day I was in a paddock and a shadow came towards me, and I realised that this was the moment. And I thought it was going to, you know, I thought this was the end, and I basically told it. I actually said, I shouted, I have a right to be. And after that, it was never as bad again, and it has never been as bad again. And that really is, you know, that's really the pinnacle dramatic moment of my life.
Mun. Thank you for sharing that story on stage. You share it in the book, but thank you for sharing it on stage. This is a deeply personal book. What you've just talked about is the most personal part.
Yeah.
You talk about it as a primal story, one that unlocks doors into an inner world otherwise kept private. And I'm wondering, how difficult was it for you to write about that, and why was it so important to you to do so?
Because if you're going to write about, you know, if I was going to write about the school and if I was going to write about the effect it had on me, you either do it or you don't do it. And I suppose at points in it I thought, well, I'll just write it, maybe I'll never show anyone. But I just kept going with it. And then once I met the other kids who'd been at the school, and particularly once I'd been to the day where these fellas had given these extraordinary speeches, then I wasn't just doing it for myself. But there were two key moments. One was when I did the conversation program with Sarah Kanofsky, the ABC Conversations program. She's like a midwife. She assisted the birth of deeply personal stories. And
Sarah has been here at this festival. I don't know if she's still here, if she's here today, but she's been at the festival.
Yeah, she was... doing an interview with her about this book was like re-entering the womb. And you basically, you open your wound and you let Australia look in. And I've done quite a lot of things in public, but that was the hardest thing I've ever done by a very long way. And then the second thing was my brother organised another meeting of fellas from the school. And I went to that with a lot of fear, because I thought if ever someone's going to step up to me and name me as a fraud, it's going to happen today. And I turned up and this bloke I'd never met bounds up to me, and there's been a very serious paedophile story in Tasmania, and he's went to our school and he's the guy behind me, and the photo of the school banned in 1966. His name's James Griffin. This bloke bounds up to me and he says, read your book, it's good. Gyron got Griffin. Gyron was one of the priests, you know. And all of a sudden, that's what happens. That it's like this giant jigsaw puzzle in your life, and you get that piece, you get that piece, you get, and you start to understand what's happened. But in the course of that day, about 20 of these blokes came up. There were no literary judgments. It was all the same. Read your book. It's good. It was good. And it was like playing a game of footy and coming off, and you've played well in the... But, you know, the boys come and say, you played well today. And so we're in this room and these fellas have never met for 50 years, and my brothers brought them together, and I dare to believe that I gave them the language to talk about it. And my favourite sound is what the Irish call the crack, the hum of a happy room, to be in a room where there's bright chatter and laughter. And we're sitting in this room and the crack's there. There's this bright chatter and laughter. And my brother said to me, this is the last scene in the movie.
Polly. Let's talk about your candour. You have lived, has to be said, a good life. You've dedicated your life to writing about poverty and inequality and class in the UK. You've walked the walk. In your book, there are amazing descriptions of the work that you did for two books that you wrote about class and inequality, which, when you read Polly's memoir, you immediately want to read these books as well. But you still feel guilty that you could have done more. And you say, and I mean, there are so many quotes in this book that I loved and underlined, but this one. To live on the left side is to live with inevitable hypocrisy, painful self-awareness, with good intentions forever destined to fall short of ideals. Could you talk about how that feels?
Yeah, and that is the nature of the beast. But on the other hand, it's what keeps you going, and it's what keeps people on the left going. And even if they have got privileged lives, professional jobs, whatever, it gives them a sense of mission, that I have an obligation towards the underdog, wherever and whoever. And I think that's very important. People recognise it in themselves. And the guilt bit is not much use, but that sense of mission for other people is very useful and very important. And I hope people reading the book, you know, who have also experienced middle-class guilt, will feel released from it in a way and say, and say, right, this is the moment I actually go out and do whatever I can. Thank you. And I suppose in my life it has been writing, and particularly perhaps, as you say, those two books. I wrote two books which are 30 years apart, which I went undercover and took manual jobs. One, when I just started in journalism and realised that, you know, a girl from a professional life, from living in London, from being to Oxford and then straight into journalism, I knew nothing about the country I was writing about. And so I took time off and I went and took jobs around the country. I worked in a car parts factory in Birmingham. I worked in a cake packing factory in London. I worked in a hospital as a ward orderly, a whole series of jobs, just to describe not poverty, but ordinary manual work. I wasn't looking for the very worst, you know, the homeless, and to look at it and understand it, really at that point for my own edification, knowing a bit more about the country that I was writing about and describing as a reporter. And I went back and did it 30 years later, when I was much more knowledgeable. I'd been the BBC social affairs editor, I'd read a huge amount of social research, I'd spent a lot of time writing about social research and writing about social things. I knew a lot more, and I knew more what I was looking at. And this time, I went lived in a council estate, living on exactly the minimum wage, and took jobs on the minimum wage from the local job centre.
Over what period was it, Polly? How long?
How long was I doing it? Mm. Well, it was around about 6 months or so.
Thought so.
And took whatever jobs I could get in the job centre, in a nursery, in a care home, in a call centre, in a cake packing factory. Same, rather different jobs because there weren't so many factories as there used to be, much more service work. And by luck, back in the same hospital where I had worked 30 years ago, it had been rebuilt, but the same hospital, in the same grade of job. This time I was a porter, last time I'd been a ward orderly. And I could take my pay packet, once in pounds, shillings and pence, and the next time in new money, to the Institute for Fiscal Studies and say, right, tell me, what am I being paid now compared with 30 years ago? The intervening years had been Thatcher and the great explosion of inequality that had happened in the country during that time in the 1980s, from which we never recovered. They looked at those pay packets and said, you're paid approximately a third less. And here in real terms, and although I've written about this in rather abstract terms and often interviewed people, made it real what had happened to the explosion in inequality in earnings and in wealth, and how devastating it's been and how we haven't recovered from it. And in fact, it's getting worse year by year. The inequality is growing. It's not getting better. We've made huge advances in social progress in terms of social you know, whether it's gay rights or, you know, a sensitivity towards rights of all kinds, but the one big one is social class and inequality, which has gone backwards. So when I talk about, in this book, about birth is destiny, I'm really shocked to find that birth is destiny more certainly now than the year I was born. Mm. You are less likely to escape wherever you're born into, which is deeply shocking.
So, Polly, when you... I don't want to say you chastise yourself, but you talk about this. You talk about the life that your sister led and that on one view she walked the talk perhaps more than you did. And I mean, I guess you do chastise yourself for feeling that you haven't lived a good enough life. How difficult is it to write with that level of candour, to dig deep and to expose your own failings or what you see as your own failings? And how important is it to do so in a memoir like this?
I think it's very important to. And it's not just your own failings, because it's quite boring if you just beat your chest and agonise. I think exploring my sister's life... My sister is 4 years older than mine, and she died a while ago. I haven't really written in detail about anybody who's still alive, which makes things a lot easier, because I have a very large family who I love deeply, and I've not written about them, not my children, not written about my other siblings. But my sister was very important to me. She was a very powerful character and a very perverse character who did everything she could to try to rid herself of exactly the guilt I'm talking about, often with quite comic results. You know, she married the wrong people, did the wrong things, tried and tried and tried again, lived a hard life in lots of ways. And in some ways, you know, it reminds me the extent to which I've lived a much more comfortable life than she did. I beat myself up less than she did. Mm. But I'm not quite sure that her way was the answer, certainly. But I think exploring, honestly, is very good for one, yourself, because you come to terms with things yourself that you felt vaguely uneasy about. And in the way that you've described so beautifully, to have to explore the things that sort of secretly hurt, nothing like the sort of hurt that you've suffered or the people that you met. But I think each of us has that within us. But mine is, on the whole, not very personal. I mean, in the sense that you can choose themes. In an autobiography, you have to choose themes. You can't just throw everything in, because everything is fascinating. Every member of your family is fascinating. Every story, anybody you stop has full of brilliant stories. You really have to choose a theme that takes you through. So the theme that I chose was social class. Mm. So it is much more about that than it is about personal things. Well, it's got quite a lot about alcoholism in it, because my family were either temperance, teetotal through the generations. And I don't know which was responsible for which. But on the whole, not deeply emotional. I mean, I've left the emotional things in my family, apart from loving my mother, tangling with my father, but, you know, left my marriages out of it, you know, things of that sort, because they didn't fit the pattern.
So the quote for this session that Louise, I assume it was, took is a quote from an article written about what it takes to make a really good memoir. And one of the things that's mentioned is that God is in the details. Now, both of your books are crammed with entertaining anecdotes. I only wish we had time to tell more of them here. I'm going to ask each of you, I'll just take you to a couple I'd like you to share. Polly, one of my favourite stories in your book is... Early days, you're a teenager still, I think, and you find yourself pregnant to your boyfriend who is about to go to Oxford. And his mother wants you to get married, and she thinks it'd be a good idea for you to go and visit his sister, who's living in a flat in Oxford. She's married. She has a baby. So you do that. Can you tell us about that visit?
Yeah, I was a year younger than he was. I was also going to be going to Oxford. And went to with him. He was delightful, and is still a friend. It's no kind of enemy story. I took me to see his sister, living in a flat in Oxford with this baby, who was about 6 months old, lying on a bath mat, no clothes, fat, pink, shock of blonde hair. Not very nice looking, I thought. Looks much the same still. Has not changed one inch.
And the baby's name?
was then Alexander, but then he coyly changed his name to Boris.
And so I should say, meeting that baby was enough for you to decide that you did not want to take that path.
I mean, I pretty much decided anyway, but if there had been a clinching moment, it would be Boris.
Just again, you've said in your family there's a rich mix of odd characters and illogical passions. There's so much to be said, and we don't have the time, I'm afraid, but about your mismatched paternal grandparents, Arnold and Rosalind. What I want to ask you about specifically, because it pertains so closely to you and your own life, is what was Rosalind like as a mother to their son Philip, your father? And in particular, I want you to tell me about what happens when baby or little Philip swallows a pin.
I think every good book needs a monster. Most of the people in the book are well-intentioned, decent, good people trying their best but often misguided in all kinds of ways. But there is one monster, and that's my grandmother, who was called Rosalind, who was married to Arnold Toynbee, who was a well-known historian, who wrote 12 volumes at the Study of History, and the year I was born was on the front page of Time magazine. He was a very popular historian in those times. And he made a terrible mistake. He had no clueless about people. Terrible mistake in who he married. My grandmother Rosalind, who was a beast and a hypocrite, and she turned against her children, except the youngest. When the youngest was born, she adored him, turned against my father and his older brother. And it kind of turned my father into a very badly behaved boy, and he was...
Chicken and egg, though, isn't it?
Chicken and egg, who knows? I think she created him by, you know, rejecting him. And all his life, he suffered from that paternal rejection, I think. You know, he was a wonderful man in many ways, but full of all kinds of faults and neuroses. But she was awful to him and everyone, and she sent him off to a prep school up the road where he didn't come home for weekends and often not for holidays when he was 6 years old. Just wanted to get rid of him. He went from one prep school to another. He kept being thrown out. No, it's true. When he swallowed a pin and they had to deal with it, which is sort of typical of Philip, that he would always cause trouble. Even when he got scabies, she said, typical of Philip that he would have a working class disease.
She is
the exception. She is a snob. And she also converted to Catholicism, given the rest of the family were passionate atheists. My grandfather had been president of the Humanists. I've been president of the Humanists. So she was rebelling against all of that, became a Catholic, went off to live with a Trappist monk, which she described as a life of total meditation and spirituality. And everybody put up with that. And after she died... Oh, she got an annulment from the Pope, from my grandfather. Only she could get an annulment. Henry VIII couldn't, but she could. Then after she died, she left behind these diaries about her wild sex life with this Trappist monk that so shocked the family. And she had been so disapproving of my cousin who had a baby out of wedlock. She had been so utterly morally disapproving. And then she left these diaries behind, by which time she was dead and you couldn't kill her, but you'd want to.
Martin, I'm going to shoot to you for an anecdote now. Tell us about the day you led the marching band astray.
One of the ways I survived was I stopped listening. And I still don't, I'm not a very good listener. And I'm a very good listener one-on-one, but if I'm being lectured, I'm not. And so I was in the school band and we're all lined up and we got called to attention and your music... And you bring your instrument up and your music up here, and it was a military band, and the drum sergeant major said, "All right, turn." And I turned left, and the band turned right. And quick march. So I marched, and the kids behind me followed. And so we headed down the drive. It was the One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest moment. And we kept playing, and we marched to freedom behind me, playing Wire Rower.
I wanted to ask you both, something that must occur to anybody that writes a memoir is the impact it might have on other people. So, Polly, you make the point. Your parents, your step-parents and your sister are all dead, but you do have half surviving half-sibling on both sides, your mother's and your father's side. And I wondered, did you speak to them? Did you show them the manuscript? Did you talk to them about what you were going to do, what you were going to write about?
A little, but not a lot. Mm. Because I realise every single one of us would have quite different stories to tell, because each, you know, each sibling is in a slightly different position according to their age and what was going on at that time in their lives. And I just felt that it wouldn't help a lot. Mm. I also thought they might not like it. I don't know. It was a risk. But I was in no way talking about them.
No.
And that was, so, I mean, if I was going to in any way speak about them, then I would certainly have done. So that they were only going to disagree about my view of our parents. They weren't going to disagree about things that were deeply personal to them. So I thought they can lump it, and mostly did.
And Martin, with you, what you were writing about was so sensitive, and what prompted you to write in particular, as you say, was attending that ritual of lament where you heard in particular those three men tell their stories. Did you speak to those men before you wrote the memoir? Did you tell them what you were going to do, and did you show them your manuscript?
I certainly did. I offered each of them the opportunity to read the manuscript. I sent them the sections they were in to make sure they believed I'd reported them accurately. Two of them I heard back from, one I didn't. And then 6 months later, just as the book was going to press, I heard from the other one, and he was dying and he wanted to read it before he died. I showed it to anyone I thought might be adversely affected by it.
I wonder with both of you whether writing this memoir, hesitant to use the words therapeutic or cathartic, but did writing the memoir help you to sort out your own feelings and to clarify, put things in perspective for you? Polly?
Yeah, I think it certainly did. It's why it took me long. I wrote it over about 10 years because I wasn't quite sure where this was going. Mm. I knew I wanted to write down some of the fascinating things about my family and going right back. But also, why would anybody care? I also felt I wanted to write about the sociology of those generations, what had happened to society in that time. Mm. And I wasn't sure I could knit those two together. So it took me a very long time to find a way where you could do that. You could tell what had happened to society and also that story. And I think it was cathartic for me in that things about my father, who was a very difficult father. He was drunk, he was wild, he was wonderful in some ways and terrible in others. He was passionate campaigner for causes. He ends up setting up a catastrophic agricultural commune because he thinks this is the way of expunging his guilt. He'll share everything. But it came a kind of crash pad for any passing hippies and was a disaster.
But he really tried.
He really tried. And I think I got a lot of that out of my system, working out what was good and not good. And certainly, in no sense, a misery memoir. If I'd written it when I was very young, I probably would have written one long whinge. As when you're older and you have children and grandchildren, you no longer feel your parents are to blame for everything. And it is in no sense, it is, if anything, it's a celebration of their lives much more than it's a whinge. You think it's not a whinge?
No, it's not absolutely not a whinge, no. It's a bit of a call to action as well, I think.
It's a call to
action. Isn't it? They're inspiring people. Martin, did you feel that writing the book helped you personally?
Because I had to go through so many fears writing it, and I had so many fears about what might happen, and none of those fears have eventuated. So I'm reminded of what Seneca said, we suffer more in the imagination than in reality. I definitely think that it's given me a lightness. It doesn't take away the horror of Gaza. It doesn't... Your life doesn't change. But, yeah, I'm glad I wrote it. Mm.
That seems like a good time to ask you if you have any questions for these two fabulous writers. If you do, if you could step up to the microphone. There's someone standing there in black in that central aisle. So I've got more if you don't, but this is a great opportunity for you to ask any questions that you might have that arise out of what we've talked about. Yes.
A question for Martin. Did your years at the school influence your later writing of championing the underdog?
The first one which it influenced my writing was the one place I found sanity and the one place that was had any magic for me was the sports field. That was the one place where I saw beauty or grace, and it was the one place where people revealed themselves. And I've written a lot of sport in my life, and it comes back to that. But yes, I think in specific response to your question, yeah, I think it absolutely did confirm my belief that what I couldn't do at the time to correct those injustices with my fists, basically, because I could have only changed those events by fighting, I could do with words. And that's why I'm so grateful to have had a career in journalism that I had. At the time I had it, at the newspaper I had it with, that gave me that freedom. So, yeah, I'm very grateful for that.
Thank you. Mm. Next question.
Yes, thank you. A question for Martin. Thank you for your presentation this morning. In the last 10 years or so, Australia's seen a Royal Commission into sexual abuse of children and institutional responses to that. I'm wondering, did any of the victims you have spoken of give evidence before that Royal Commission? If so, what was their experience? Did it help them to overcome this trauma? And did you participate in any way with that Royal Commission? And do you think the Catholic Church has learned anything from its gross hypocrisy and protection of these victims?
I don't think you can answer all of that last question, but perhaps the early ones, Martin.
I didn't give evidence. This book is my evidence. There are certainly a number of characters in the book who did give evidence. The hero of the book is a kid called Rinso. I saw him get badly bashed when I was 11. When I tracked him down 50 years later to talk about it, he said he thought he won the fight, which was pretty amazing. He gave evidence at the Royal Commission. As for the Catholic Church, I think they are, from what I know, shell-shocked. I think it's an institution which is desperately trying to work out who it is and where it goes from here. That's as I know it.
Thank you, Martin. Does someone have a question for Polly? Step forward if you've got a question for Polly. Yes,
I'm
please.
I'm sorry, Polly, it's not.
Sorry, I will take one for Polly, please.
I wonder if you would like to comment on, in terms of your the class system in England, a woman, your women's position. Because my experience is that it was quite different in the middle class in England than it is in Australia, for example.
Sorry, that was quite...
Yes, I'm not quite sure... If you could just repeat the question, please,
well,
that it was...
You being
the situation of being a woman in the middle class is a particular one.
Yes. You don't mention, in terms of the class system, where you were placed as a woman in that system.
Well, it's what's called kind of intersectionality, isn't it? it's... Everything is different for women and for men. It's true. And, you know, when I was growing up, women had many fewer rights. When I first got married and I bought a washing machine on hire purchase, I had to get my husband to sign for it, despite the fact I had my own job. And, it's amazing what a long way we've come in that sense. In that sense, life for women has got much better. But class-wise, it's got much worse. I think life for working-class women, in some ways, is freer. They can escape their abusive partners or partners they don't want to live with in a way that they couldn't have done 50 years ago. so that women everywhere are freer than they were. But I think what's most shocking is that while things like, you know, race and gender and gay rights and all of those things have improved, I think what's most shocking is that in terms of class, the real meaning of class, not the trivia, the economic and opportunities of class have gone backwards. So you could say you win some, you lose some. But the biggest one we've lost so far.
The gentleman in the hat.
Martin, referring to when you said your brother organised the old boys and they were supportive of you. I'm a Marist of class of 72. And when we had crows up on charges and stuff like that, and I went to the old boys and said, look, we should be supporting these people, they were down on me like a ton of bricks, right? You know, they were friends of the crows sort of thing. So I imagine people come up to you all the time and say, well, this was my experience with the old boys. How is it falling? You had old boys that were supportive of the unknown victim, whereas mine was different. Are you finding that there's a split there?
I haven't found that, but that might be because I wrote a book. And to speak to me about it, you've really got to have read the book. And I haven't found anyone. No one's come up and been aggressive or negative to me about it.
I'm sorry, but I think we're going to have to wrap up there. You will get the opportunity, though. Please take the opportunity to go and buy these two fabulous books. Martin and Polly will both be sitting over there in the usual place, signing books when you go to buy them. Please join with me in thanking Polly Toynbee and Martin Flanagan. Thank you.